This is Frankly MSP, where managed service providers get real.
Hey, and welcome to episode 31 of Frankly MSP, the podcast for managed service providers who want to boost their productivity, efficiency, and profitability. I'm your host, Jennifer Tribe. I wanted to kick off today's show by sharing a review of the podcast that we recently received on iTunes from a user called Calypsian. Calypsian says, "Shh, don't tell anybody. Frankly MSP is our superpower. I've been listening to Frankly MSP from the start, and it has had a measurable impact on our SF Bay Area MSP. I've even gone so far as to write down quotes from the guests and share them in all staff meetings as inspiration for our discussion. My favorite was Don Crawley's analogy comparing technology to a foreign language from episode 9. The review goes on to say more, but I just wanted to share that little snippet with you. I love hearing that Frankly MSP is providing practical information that people are able to use in their day-to-day businesses as service providers. That's the whole point, really. So thank you to Calypsian for taking the time to share your thoughts on that and letting us know that we're hitting the mark. Now, my guest today on the podcast is Brian Dozel, co-founder and CEO of a software company called BrightGauge. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. They basically offer amazing data tracking and dashboarding for MSPs. BrightGauge was born from Brian's experience leading sales and marketing for an MSP and needing a place to pull together and work with all of the metrics he was coming across in his day-to-day work. Brian and I got talking about numbers and the idea that everyone in your company should have one that they're working on. We talk about why this idea of a number is so important, how to pick the right numbers for your team members, how to incent, and just as importantly, how not to incent people to work on their numbers, and lots of other tips and tricks along the way. That's later in the show, but first we turn to what's going on. This week we've got Carl and Richard back, or, well, just have a listen.
You're listening to Frankly MSP, brought to you by Avic Networks.
Hey folks, Richard Tubb here, and I'm sitting here in my studio in freezing cold Newcastle upon Tyne, where the cloud is up in the sky as always. And as always, again, I am joined by my good friend and MSP expert, Carl Palachuk. Carl, how the heck are you?
Mate, I'm doing wonderfully well. Nice to be here, Richard, and super excited to have another awesome chat about all things MSP.
And as you guys can tell, we are just joking. We're here to give you the view this week from the land down under. So I'm now joined by my good friend, Jamie Warner, out here in Australia. Back when I had my MSP, Jamie would have been an arch rival of mine. You still run your MSP out here. I have since sold and I am in the vendor space now, but welcome Jamie to the show.
Thanks, Nigel. Great to be here. And your name, of course, your real name. What's your full real name?
Nigel Moore.
Very good. No, it's super exciting to be here. Yeah, really excited to give you guys a different perspective for this podcast. I know Nigel's drum up some amazing little topics to have a chat about, so looking forward to getting stuck in.
So browsing through the MSP news recently, one of the articles that caught my attention was titled, "How Much Should You Really Be Paying for Ads in an MSP?" And now this is targeted at people that are doing pay-per-click advertising, typically through Facebook ads or LinkedIn ads or most prominently, Google ads. And it was talking about how much should an MSP really be spending. And I think it's a kind of pertinent conversation because in my coaching experience, a lot of MSPs that I speak to really struggle with how to pay for advertising in this space. Now, I know you have built a very successful MSP off the back of advertising. So I thought it'd be a really good conversation just to figure out and understand and go backwards and forwards about where we see MSPs are maybe making mistakes or just not seeing the opportunity out there for where they can be spending money on ads to go and get new clients in the door.
It's a great topic. I think if you break it down in terms of what an MSP can do to generate new business, you obviously, the first and most common method that we all use is, of course, referrals. We are professional services businesses. We're relationship businesses. As such, we tend to get most of our business by doing a great job and getting referred in. And that could be referrals from existing customers, or it could be referrals from partners and suppliers, etc. So that's the main one. And for growing my MSP, which I started in 2000, we're about 42 staff now, and we did that organically. Probably back in about 07, 08, it's been quite some time, we started doing Google AdWords as an advertising methodology. And look, it's been the backbone of growing our MSP, I have to say. It's one of those solutions, I guess, where you're getting leads at the time someone's actually looking for it. So if you're in your city listening to this podcast, at any point in time, there are people sitting there looking to find a new IT provider, and they're further down the buying journey. They're not sort of thinking, oh, should I start outsourcing? No, they've been burnt. There's been an issue and they need to find someone. So AdWords has been fantastic for our MSP and we can continue to use it.
As you say, it is one of those things where the people that are searching for the particular pain are currently in pain to the point where they are very deep down in the sales cycle. So when people are out there advertising at the moment, perhaps in industry trade magazine or even referral networking or nurturing out at networking events and whatnot, the people that you meet at those events are typically not at a point of pain like the people that are searching on Google AdWords. So typically what happens when you start doing Google AdWords advertising is that you are finding the people so deep in pain that they're ready to buy pretty quickly. And that means they've got a really short sales cycle. And now this is where I see a lot of MSPs go wrong or make a mistake a lot of the time, is that they jump onto Google Ads because they hear that from everybody else that Google Ads is working really well for their MSP. They've probably heard you talk about it, Jamie. And what they do is they go out, they start a Google ad and they throw a couple of $100 at it, and they might get 2 or 3 or 4 clicks and they don't get a new client off it, and they class it as a failure. Now that is a big, big, big mistake, because quite frankly, they just have not spent enough money to get the results that you need to get out of these ads. And in Google Ads or in any type of advertising medium, there's a couple of key metrics to look out for. In an ad campaign, one of the main metrics that you're looking out for is your cost per acquisition of a customer. How much is it costing you in your ad spend to get one particular customer? And in the MSP space, that number can float somewhere around the $1,000 to $5,000 range, sometimes a little bit lower than $1,000, but especially when you're starting out, you don't know what's working and what's not. So it typically floats up in the higher range. Now, people may look at that and go, hey, that is kind of expensive. I'm not going to spend $1,000 or $2,000 to get a customer. But the second metric that people overlook in here is the lifetime value of your existing customer. When you bring on a managed service agreement client, and perhaps it's a $2,000 a month client, and maybe they've got 60% gross margin in there, so you're making over $1,000 per month gross margin out of that client. You would be happy to go and spend 2, 3, or 4 months of that client's gross margin to attract that client, because you know that once you get a managed service client, you keep them for a long, 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 long time. Especially if you're doing good work, you can keep them forever, and that can be years, which means the lifetime value of that particular client is in the tens of thousands of dollars, and you've only spent $1,000 to $2,000 to $3,000 to get them. So it's kind of a no-brainer when you look at it like that, but it is a tough step for MSPs that are just getting started into this space. And that's my encouragement, is just go out and realize that you need to spend a little bit more to be able to get those clients in the door, knowing full well the margins are typically there to get back your ad spend within the first couple of months fairly easily.
Absolutely. No, I totally concur with that. And I have to say, those business metrics is something that I learned. I didn't learn them as an MSP. It's just going into Envirosoft and doing a B2B SaaS product has been quite interesting. And they have a concept called unit economics. And that's basically what Nigel's talking about, where they actually call it customer acquisition cost, your CAC, and then your LTV is the same, so lifetime value. And so most MSPs typically, well, and our MSP, I can speak from my experience, but it seems to be the same when I speak to other MSPs, have probably around 5 years or 60 months as their average lifetime value. It is quite a sticky service. We're fortunate that we have great lifetime value. When the lifetime value of the deal, so if it's $1,000 a month and it's 60 months, that's $60,000 that you're basically going to earn. Now, in the SaaS world, interestingly, they'll say that if you've spent probably up to about 12 months, anything 12 months or less to get that customer, it's actually not too bad. So in our world, we don't have huge budgets. We haven't got VC-backed businesses, so we probably need to be a bit more conservative. But as Nigel, I agree with you, if it's 3 or 4 months cost, it's probably worth it in regards to the long term. I mean, it is worth it because the maths are the math. Just to give you an example, we probably spend $2,000 to $3,000 a month on Google, but it's a set marketing cost now. Because the way I saw it was, every time I signed up a customer, the first couple that added up to $2,000 or $3,000 covered the cost. So now, if you're sort of looking at a graph kind of going from bottom left to top right, the cost has pretty much stayed the same, but we're up probably over $100,000 or $150,000 of what we've signed up over a number of years. It's probably more than that. I should do a calculation on it, because of course you've got churn and everything else, but you're way ahead of the game. You've just got to work out your economics. And once you do, you'll then be able to determine whether or not it's going to be the right thing for you. So I agree with you, Nigel, that you can't spend a couple of $100 and expect it to work. You've really got to give it a few months. In terms of how many leads we get, we may only get one or two leads a month. Some months we get zero, but some other months we get three. So it's not super consistent, but over a year, and that's why with any marketing, you should really do it over a 12-month period or as long as you can, so that you can go, okay, I did a year. How many leads did I actually get? How many did I convert? What did I spend? What is the ROI when I factor in lifetime value? Did it make sense? And usually when you factor in the lifetime value, it does. So yeah, I recommend you do it.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the key outcome out of this one is, should you be spending more money on ads? Yes, you typically should. If you want more clients, that's the likely area to go and spend money. Go out there, get your unit economics right, and go and start testing, tweaking, measuring, and fine-tuning and seeing what works. So one of the articles I read in the Channel Futures magazine recently was about this new service from Microsoft called Microsoft Managed Desktops. Now, this is one of these as-a-service offerings, and it's where Microsoft will offer to its end users an entire desktop. So you'll be able to get a Surface. They're starting out with their Surface range for a fixed monthly cost. But in addition, they will throw in all the services around that, including all your setup and your support and your help desk. Now, that is raising some questions amongst MSPs around the world as to, is this Microsoft taking another step onto my turf or onto my territory? And where is this going to go? And one of the things that popped up immediately in my head, and it's got some sort of overlaps into this, is back when Office 365 was starting to get some traction back quite a few years ago, and Microsoft came out with an offering of, we are now going to give you guys and girls free Exchange migrations to come into Office 365. And a lot of MSPs stood up and went, oh, wow, they're stepping on our turf here. What does the future hold? And the way I see it, we're now 5, 6, 7, 8 years after that. And honestly, in the S of the SMB space, or the S and the M of our space, the small to medium enterprise, I have not seen that particular offering make a dent in any MSPs. When the news first came out, there was all this fanfare and all these people worried about it. But as yet, I have not heard that anybody has seen any type of dent sitting in their offering, whether it's via their revenue or whether it's via losing deals to Microsoft or whatnot. And I think in this Microsoft Managed Desktop as a Service thing, I suspect it's going to be fairly similar. And the main reason I say that is that small business, and I'm a fundamental believer of this, in that small business owners and small business people always typically love dealing with other small businesses. Now, Microsoft is not a small business. And so that's where the partner channel has such an opportunity and such a great space, in that we are the buffer between the big enterprise and the small businesses. And so I still feel that even an offering like this, even though it's coming out and people are getting worried about it and whatnot, I don't feel it's going to make a dent in most managed service providers' revenue. What are your thoughts on that, Jamie?
Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, there's that initial concern and anxiety when you have a big provider like Microsoft have a crack and go direct in this regard. And to a degree, they already did it in Australia, for those listening, when they first launched Office 365. You couldn't resell it. It was basically, they picked one provider, which is our biggest telecommunications company in the country, Telstra, and they had the rights for a few years to actually sell it. So we weren't overly enthused to sell Office 365 because it wasn't a stickiness. You sort of opened up the door to this massive telco. And so I personally had concerns as an MSP owner when that actually happened. Then, of course, they changed the model and opened it up to the channel, which is really a Microsoft is a channel business. So it was a bit unusual that they did that. But this is just another iteration of that, and Microsoft trying to grow their subscription revenue and along with the channels. So I agree. I don't think it's going to have a huge impact. I think the market's already transitioned in a way. So in my MSP, we've been around a long time. And so we had clients that were in that 5-seat, 8-seat, 10-seat range. But I think with the advent of just everything SaaS, and that includes Office 365, your accounting in the cloud and files and folders in the cloud, all that sort of stuff. If you're a business from, say, 5 to 10 seats or even 15 or even up to 20 seats, you can probably, maybe not after 10, but it starts getting a bit more complicated with networking and routers and switching and all that sort of jazz. But that fundamentally, you can kind of get away without an IT provider. So I think this is going to be perfect for really small clients. But as MSPs, we've got to move up the value chain a wee bit. And so we now really are looking at businesses with 20 seats and above. That's your ideal client. They're going to have more complexity, which requires a partner. And below that, potentially this might cut in a little bit. But again, I agree. I mean, I think small businesses love partners. They love to have someone they can rely on. It's usually one piece of the puzzle, just getting the desktop. I mean, it's not, you know, you get your desktop, you get your subscription. Half these people aren't going to know how to migrate from one platform to Office 365 with their email anyway. You've got to remember that non-technical people, they just hate this stuff. They just don't want to do that. They want to do what they're good at. So I'm not overly concerned about it as an MSP owner, but I think you need to acknowledge what's going on. You need to keep a close eye on it and adjust accordingly where possible. It wouldn't surprise me if you could start to resell it.
And you touched on a really good point there in that particular article on the Channel Futures blog. They talk about that if this goes well, they've got to figure out how to integrate this into their partner ecosystem and how that would work. And I actually see it as a really great opportunity in the long term for our partners, because when you look at most MSPs nowadays, and typically the space that I coach, which are typically under $2 million in revenue, they devote a lot of their resources and capacity to dealing with the boring managed patching and managed security and managed update kind of stuff. That's not an amazing value proposition that you can go out and grow a big business with over the long term. And so what this does is, just like it did with Microsoft Exchange, you now don't have to worry about Microsoft Exchange patches taking out your weekend. Now you may not have to worry about Microsoft desktop patches failing on desktops, because you can just hand that across to Microsoft and you can take, as you said, a step up that value chain and become more trusted advisor, educating them on how they can better use this technology for their business and how they can be more efficient and more effective in what they do and how they can extract more profit out of their business by using all this technology. And that's where there is huge, huge, huge opportunity over this next decade for the smart MSPs out there to go and start offering their clients that as a service, this technology adoption and technology enablement and technology education. And if we can get all that low-level stuff off our plates, that managed desktop patching and Exchange patching, which Office 365 did for us, and all those kinds of things, it allows the smart MSPs to take that step up and charge more for that technology adoption consulting, which is so needed by so many businesses out there, even the small businesses.
Absolutely.
So Jamie, or should I say Carl, I think it is time that we wrap things up before Jennifer kicks us off this podcast. So hopefully all you folks listening, you've been able to understand our crazy Aussie accents. I know I speak a little bit fast and I make no apologies over that. I ask you to listen faster instead of asking me to speak slower. However, we are now going to hand the microphones back to the professionals so that we can go and ride our kangaroos down to the beach and head out for a surf. Jamie/Carl, thank you for being on. It has been a pleasure, and hopefully we get to do this again soon.
Thanks, mate. Look forward to seeing you soon.
You're listening to Frankly MSP.
A big thank you to Nigel and Jamie for co-hosting What's Going On This Week. I hope you enjoyed their take on current events. Of course, loyal Frankly MSP listeners will remember both of those guys from previous interviews on the podcast. Nigel Moore joined me on episode 8, talking about how his MSP built a library of over 1,000 standard operating procedures and how that helped him not only run a great MSP, but ultimately sell that MSP at a very favorable price. And Jamie was my guest on episode 29 just a month ago, sharing his pyramid of MSP success. Amazing nuggets in both of those episodes, so if you haven't listened to them yet, make sure you go back and do that. Next up in this episode is my interview with Brian Dozel, co-founder and CEO of BrightGauge, where we talk about best practices in metrics. Hi, Brian. Welcome to Frankly MSP.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on the show today because BrightGauge is one of those products that we see everywhere in the MSP space. You offer such an important tool for the MSP toolset, and we're going to be talking about metrics today. I know that one of the things that you say a lot is that everyone in the organization should have a number. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was Peter Drucker, management guru way back in the 50s, always said, you can't manage what you can't measure. So for me, that made a lot of sense as a numbers guy. And for business owners, team leads, seeing how the company's doing, like, it's easy to put numbers on that stuff. So I've always been kind of accustomed to just measuring myself, how we're progressing as a company. But really, you know, you start managing a team, especially a team that's growing, it starts getting harder to manage, right? One of the best disciplines that I kind of forced myself to have, and a lot of books agree with this, is try to have everyone following some sort of KPI for themselves. And also from a team perspective as well. If as a manager, we can get disciplined enough where we can find a number that matters to that individual, then we can sure as heck motivate them. They can self-motivate and just things really regulate themselves once there's a single focus and a measure that's black and white. And that's the beautiful thing about having a number that's we're going after. It can be very much black and white.
So Traction by Gino Wickman, I know this is a very popular book among MSPs, and we've had Gino's co-author, Mike Payton, on the podcast before talking about the entrepreneurial operating system. So as part of that system, Gino says, you know, there's a data component, and as part of that data component, he has this idea that everybody should have a number. So is the BrightGauge idea of everyone having a number tied to the Traction book in some way? Were you inspired by it? Was it the other way around? How does that fit in?
It's a good question because we were following this concept before that, right? So our product's been out for a while. And so we were naturally inclined to put a dashboard up and let's have everyone focus on a number. And what I'll tell you, once we read the book Traction, it validated a lot of the stuff that we were, especially the data component, a lot of the stuff that we were already doing. It just reinvigorated us saying, now this is right. Like, this is a common principle. We just have to fight our way through the hard, stickier parts for someone that may not have a number that's so obvious. So service people, tickets closed, hours entered, very easy to measure. Developers, accounting people, harder. I think Gino's book, not only did it simplify a whole lot of other stuff, but it just kind of excited us about, no, we got to find that number. The accounts receivable person was my favorite one. How many invoices did they send out? You know, just some number to put that people manage to.
And how do you go about deciding what's the right number for the right person?
It's hard. It's harder when it's not as clear. Again, like going back for us having software developers, it's challenging for an accounting person. One of the things that that book, and there's another concept called OKRs, Objective Key Results, that like Google follows. Either way, this long range planning, it's all about iteration and also getting buy-in from the person. So we just sit down with the individual. A lot of the ones that we've gotten have kind of stuck for the last 6 months, but you should be reviewing them quarterly, trying something, iterating on top of that, trying it again, seeing what failed, and just going back and forth. For example, you can't have something that then becomes the sole focus and then something else suffers. So you kind of have to have this secondary number that kind of watches that. And that gets a little bit tricky for those folks that are hard to have numbers. But if you're working with an employee or if you're an employee working with a manager, it should be a together thing that then you're comfortable saying, man, that was wrong, and trying again, or sticking with what works.
So if you're an MSP and let's say you have five technicians, would you give every technician the same KPI or would you adjust it based on the individual?
Yeah, great question, because we have that all the time. In our product, by the way, there's this little, we have this goals section that allows people to assign numbers to people. And it's very similar to the scorecards in Traction world. So we deal with a lot of questions from MSPs. Say, hey, what number should I do? We tell people it has to be specific, and it has to be specific to the behavior. If you want to change a behavior, to the behavior you want to change, and staying focused on just that. So if someone may be really good at closing tickets, but their customer satisfaction is terrible, so then that's a number they should be watching every week, not the closing tickets. I always tell folks, MSPs, like, don't pick the same one. And for sure, after a few months, and again, we're not the best at this, replace it with something else, because that number will become the norm. And then people will just, you know, it's automatic. So you don't want that to happen. You want somebody, you're changing a behavior or improving behavior.
So in that example, you would give someone the KPI to improve their customer satisfaction score. But once that was under control, then you would shift to something else?
Yeah, something else. Like, how many tickets are they escalated to? Wait times, always keeping this and goals, which is part of the Traction world and this other OKR world that we follow. It's all about changing things to the individual. That way there's personal buy-in. And this is what it's all about. Like, it's not just a number that we're whipping you if we don't get it right. It's about personal buy-in, personal accountability, letting them manage, you know, get to that number. And if they're self-motivated, that's the holy grail, I guess we can call it, management. And that's where these numbers have to change constantly and be interactive and work with the employee about it. So certainly changing is good.
You touched a little bit on how you would track these numbers and when you would check in, but can you talk more about how you build that focus on numbers into your team culture?
Sure. Yeah. Us having a dashboard product and KPIs is our world. We're probably better at this than most in the sense that this is our livelihood. It starts with me being very transparent with the numbers that I track for myself. And these numbers are not just personal things that I want to get done, but also company KPIs. So I am very transparent, and therefore it makes it a little bit easier to get everyone else to feel that same transparency and participate as well. So that starts there, and I have a monthly hands-on meeting, you know, everyone together, and I go through all the numbers, what's good, what's bad, and I explain it, give context. We're big on context. And I do that verbally, and then that goes down to the team level and the teams. Everyone has weekly meetings for the most part, and then they incorporate the review of those numbers in those weekly meetings, as well as in our product itself, the goals feature.
So you as the CEO have your metrics that everybody can see, and they know how you're tracking against those numbers. And then in your monthly meeting, are you talking about your metrics or are you looking at everybody's metrics?
Talking about mine, which a lot of times is the company or is a new, it will benefit them to hear about it. It's mostly about me and where we went wrong, where I went wrong, and how we're heading and how that impacts future stuff. So very much the team stuff, I keep it very localized within their team. There is in our product itself, like, emails go out to everyone in the company with your goals, with your numbers and how you did over the previous week, with your context of you checking in. But that's a very passive way to look at it. It does help with accountability, but I'm never coming across someone else's team and be like, hey, why'd you miss this number? I leave that to the team leads.
Going back to the idea that everybody should have a number. So CEO has a number, technicians have a number. I can see some MSPs saying, well, you know, maybe my accounting or bookkeeping person doesn't need a number because that's not really what we're focused on. But would you recommend that literally everybody in the company has a number?
Yeah, it sounds silly. And I'm sure Gino's co-author probably said the same thing, but you just find something, whether it's an annoyance. We actually had, when my brother was with us, he was very operationally focused. And before we hired an office administrator, we wanted to give that function, which he owned, a number. We said it has to have a number. And literally the number we gave was, how many, this sounds silly, but how many days was the office out of water? Because he, unfortunately, was in charge of reordering water. And finally, at some point, he was missing a few weeks in a row. And it's like, we just got to hire someone because I know it's silly and it's just water, but it's symptomatic of other things that were missing. And so as straightforward as a tick at the end of the day saying, okay, I missed this day, we would track that stuff and it just helped provide visibility and like, oh, wow, like half the days we're out of water. Eric's busy doing other stuff. Like we should probably fix that problem. You know, we fix it. Life moves on and people are happy. You know, it's just, it helps. Yes, I'm a huge believer. Everyone, no matter how silly it sounds, for me, one quarter was talking to three customers a week about a certain feature. And it's just something that I wanted to hold myself accountable to. And it wasn't something that's automatically tracked. I had to write it on a notepad and then input it in my weekly scorecard and breakage. But that was one of my numbers. So yeah, everyone, you can come up with it. It's easy.
And I like that idea of using the numbers that might seem kind of random and insignificant as leading indicators of when you might need to staff up or where you're having gaps and shortfalls.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And for the MSP world, the concept of leading and lagging indicators is big, but the way I always preach is just keep everything simple, right? Like if someone's responsible for something, leading or lagging, like I agree, that's the concept we want to get them to, but just pick something, start with it, and you'll see it. And Gino talks about this. It just visualizes your company. That's a huge win. I mean, those simple things, we just keep on hammering into MSPs' mindsets. And once they start implementing this stuff, their lives feel calmer. They may not associate with that silly number they give to the accounting person, but it does work. And that's why we've been successful today with the product, actually. Just numbers and visibility is a huge part of management.
You mentioned delivering numbers in a meeting, numbers in an email. What about TV screens around the office and other sort of forms of shared dashboards?
Yeah, our dashboards is bread and butter of the business. And you know, having that visibility out in open space. And MSPs are very good about having that knock mentality, you know, that operations center with screens everywhere. So they usually have the spots for it. For us, we have a simplicity mindset, just throw a few numbers. And this is more team-based numbers, not individuals. Put those up so people know what should they be thinking about when they're going out to an office. So I give an example. There's a customer of ours we really respect, and they have this big monitor as soon as you walk in, and it has their top 10 customers' client satisfaction score. And so every day when their employees walk in and walk out, like it's like branding, right? A billboard. They say, what's most important? Customer satisfaction. I think that's a great idea. Just that team, you know, what is important, just showing that on a dashboard is big. The problem with dashboards and where this assigning KPIs really helps out is that dashboards are a bit passive in who owns the numbers. So yes, people are thinking about customer satisfaction, but it's different than saying, you, Eric, my brother, you own how many days we're out of water every week. And that's a different mentality, but both have a similar impact.
So best practice would be to have some sort of roll-up team dashboard with metrics on it, and then each person have their own individual metrics that they're tracking.
Yes. And best practice being hopefully three or four numbers, not 45 that we've seen many people try to do.
So, but everybody should have one number. Should people take it that literally? You have one number that you focus on, or could it be a set?
No. No. Yeah, a set is, if you can get a set, it's great. Andy Grove said this one, the former CEO of Intel, where you got to have, I forgot the phrase he used, but you got to have one number. Let's say it's closing the most amount of tickets, but you got to have another number for that same individual that says customer satisfaction, because you don't want that person closing 100 tickets, but ticking off every single customer. So if you can find the balance KPIs, that's ideal. Or you just do a couple of them that you want to have that person focus on for the quarter. The risk is too much. Again, going back to the simplicity mindset, even if just one number for 3 months, they hammer that away, like that's okay. Best practice, maybe two or three, but no more than that.
And what are you seeing in terms of incentive programs around these numbers? So we've talked about, you know, you've got to be accountable and people are going to be checking and have your numbers improved. But what are you seeing in terms of rewards, bonuses, parties, cheering when somebody hits a number, that kind of stuff?
Great question. This is debatable. So I'll give you what we follow and kind of what we've seen. So rule of thumb is you don't want to compensate purely based on those numbers that you're selecting with that other individual. One, because then it doesn't incent the person to pick very easy numbers or easy targets that they want to hit with those numbers, which you don't want. You want to improve behavior. You don't want, just want them to be, human nature will kick in and try to manipulate the system. So we try to avoid that. Also, not everyone's monetarily focused, right? So salespeople, of course, pay them on it, but not everyone's like that. So what we've seen and what we've heard and the way we do it is more of the group celebrations when the group hits their number. And everyone's target is, for the most part, rolls up into a greater goal for the whole team. So customer satisfaction, it might be that the level two person that quarter needs to focus on lowering response times for these certain tickets because they know that that'll impact customer satisfaction. And if customer satisfaction does go down to a certain level at the end of the quarter, you take the whole team out. We've always suggested avoid compensating directly on these numbers because then it's just compensation package versus this is how you want to self-improve. And compensation is kind of this different thing.
So it's more group rewards and it's very transparent.
Yeah, as much as possible. There's one guy we saw in LA that had one dashboard, one single number on it, and it was the days since last negative review. And if that number ticked up to 90, so 90 days since the last negative review, they would have some blowout party, you know, 12, you know, young folks that worked for them. And so that number was on a huge TV, just one number. And that was, we talk about singularly focused, that and then our team celebration at the end.
Okay, so parting advice, you're an MSP, maybe you've done a little bit of tracking, you want to get started on getting people the right numbers. What's the first step they should take?
Besides signing up with Breakage? No, the first step is just trying something. Literally, we tell it, I think it's, we even have a blog post about it. Just start for a quarter or start for 6 weeks, enough time for you to see what happens and make sure that you're disciplined. If you are in a management CEO, president, CEO, whatever position, it starts with you. So make sure that you start with your own numbers, then roll it out to maybe some other leaders or at least strong employees, and then go from there. But just start and then you'll iterate from there. I mean, we've been doing this for 4 years and I feel like maybe 18 months ago, we really got into a groove with it. So it does take time, but you can't get there without just starting.
That's great advice. Thanks, Brian, for joining us today.
No problem, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
That was Brian Dozel, CEO of BrightGage. I'll put a link to Brian's contact info, the traction book we mentioned, and those quotes Brian talks about in today's show notes at ovic.com/franklymsp/031. Also, if you're interested in hearing that interview with Mike Payton from the EOS organization that I mentioned during the interview, you'll find that in Frankly MSP episode 6. And that's a wrap. Remember to subscribe to Frankly MSP wherever you get your podcasts for each episode as it drops. Till next time, this is Jennifer Tribe. Thanks for listening.
Frankly MSP, brought to you by Ovic Networks, the most efficient and profitable way to manage your clients' networks.